Jessie closed her eyes tightly. 6 years ago, she had spent an abortive 4-month period in counseling, not telling Gerald because she knew he would be sarcastic, and probably worried about what beans she might be spilling. She had stated her problem as stress, and Nora Callaghan, her therapist, had taught her a simple relaxation technique. Most people associate counting to 10 with Donald Duck trying to keep his temper, Nora had said. But what a 10 count really does is to give you a chance to reset all your emotional dials. And anybody who doesn't need an emotional reset at least once a day has probably got problems a lot more serious than yours or mine. This voice was also clear, clear enough to raise a small, wistful smile on her face. I liked Nora. I liked her a lot. Had she, Jessie, known that at the time? She was moderately astounded to find she couldn't exactly remember, any more than she could exactly remember why she had quit going to see Nora on Tuesday afternoons. She supposed that a bunch of stuff, community chest, the Court Street homeless shelter, maybe the new library fund drive, had just come up all at once. Shit happens, as another piece of New Age vapidity passing for wisdom pointed out. Quitting had probably been for the best, anyway. If you didn't draw the line somewhere, therapy just went on until you and your therapist dotted off to that great group encounter session in the sky together. Never mind, go ahead and do the count, starting with your toes. Do it just the way she taught you. Yes, why not? One is for feet. 10 little toes, cute little piggies all in a row. Except that 8 were comically croggled, and her great toes looked like the heads on a pair of ball-peen hammers. 2 is for legs, lovely and long. Well, not that long. She was only 5'6", after all. But Gerald had claimed they were still her best feature, at least in the old sex appeal department. She had always been amused by this claim, which seemed to be perfectly sincere on his part. He had somehow missed her knees, which were as ugly as the knobs on an apple tree, and her chubby upper thighs. 3 is my sex. What's right can't be wrong. Mildly cute. A little too cute, many might say, but not very illuminating. She raised her head a little as if to look at the object in question, but her eyes remained closed. She didn't need her eyes to see it anyway. She had been coexisting with that particular accessory for a long time. What lay between her hips was a triangle of ginger-colored, crinkly hair surrounded by an unassuming slit with all the aesthetic beauty of a badly healed scar. This thing, this organ that was really little more than a deep fold of flesh cradled by crisscrossing belts of muscle, seemed to her an unlikely wellspring from myth, but it certainly held mythic status in the collective male mind. It was the magic veil, wasn't it? The corral where even the wildest unicorns were eventually penned. Mother McCree, what bullshit, she said, smiling a little but not opening her eyes. Except it wasn't bullshit, not entirely. That slit was the object of every man's lust, the heterosexual ones at least. But it was also frequently an object of their inexplicable scorn, distrust, and hate. You didn't hear that dark anger in all their jokes, but it was present in enough of them, and in some it was right out front, raw as a sore. What's a woman? A life support system for a cunt. Stop it, Jessie, Goodwife Burlingame ordered. Her voice was upset and disgusted. Stop it right now. That, Jessie decided, was a damned good idea, and she turned her mind back to Nora's 10 count. 4 was for her hips, too wide, and 5 her belly, too thick. 6 was her breasts, which she thought were her best feature. Gerald, she suspected, was a bit put off by the vague tracings of blue veins beneath their smoothly sloping curves. The breasts of the gatefold girls in his magazines did not show such hints of the plumbing beneath. The magazine girls didn't have tiny hairs growing out of their areolae, either. 7 was her too wide shoulders. 8 was her neck, which used to be good-looking but had grown decidedly chickeny in the last few years. 9 was her receding chin, and 10... Wait a minute! Wait just one goddamn minute here! The no-bullshit voice broke in furiously. What kind of dumb game is this? Jessie shut her eyes tighter, appalled by the depth of anger in that voice and frightened by its separateness. In its anger, it didn't seem like a voice coming from the central taproot of her mind at all, but like a real interloper, an alien spirit that wanted to possess her the way the spirit of Panzuzu had possessed the little girl in The Exorcist. Don't want to answer that? Ruth Neary, alias Panzuzu, asked. Okay, maybe that one's too complicated. Let me make it really simple for you, Jess. Who turned Nora Callaghan's simple little relaxation litany into a mantra of self-hatred? No one, she thought back meekly, and knew at once that the no-bullshit voice would never accept that. So she added, The good wife, it was her. No, it wasn't. Ruth's voice returned at once. She sounded disgusted at this half-assed effort to shift the blame. Goody's a little stupid, and right now she's a lot scared, but she's a sweet enough thing at the bottom, and her intentions have always been good. The intentions of whoever re-edited Nora's list were actively evil. Jesse, don't you see that? Don't you... I don't see anything because my eyes are closed, she said in a trembling, childish voice. She almost opened them, but something told her that was apt to make the situation worse instead of better. Who was the one, Jesse? Who taught you that you were ugly and worthless? Who picked out Gerald Burlingame as your soulmate in Prince Charming, probably years before you actually met him at that Republican Party mixer? Who decided he wasn't only what you needed, but exactly what you deserved? With a tremendous effort, Jessie swept this voice, all the voices she fervently hoped, out of her mind. She began the mantra again, this time speaking it aloud. One is my toes, all in a row. Two is my legs, lovely and long. Three is my sex, what's right can't be wrong. Four is my hips, curving and sweet. Five is my stomach, where I store what I eat. She couldn't remember the rest of the rhymes, which was probably a mercy. She had a strong suspicion that Nora had whomped them up herself, probably with an eye toward publication in one of the soft and yearning self-help magazines which sat on the coffee table in her waiting room, and so went on without them. Six is my breasts. Seven's my shoulders. Eight's my neck. She paused to take a breath and was relieved to find her heartbeat had slowed from a gallop to a fast run. Nine is my chin, and 10 is my eyes. Eyes open wide. She suited the action to the words, and the bedroom jumped into bright existence around her, somehow new, and for the moment at least, almost as delightful as it had been to her when she and Gerald had spent their first summer in this house. Back in 1979... a year which once had the ring of science fiction and now seemed impossibly antique. Jessie looked at the gray barnboard walls, the high white ceiling with its reflected shimmers from the lake, and the two big windows, one on either side of the bed. The one to her left looked west, giving a view of the deck, the sloping land beyond it, and the heartbreaking bright blue of the lake. The one on her right provided a less romantic vista, the driveway in her gray dowager of a Mercedes, now 8 years old and beginning to show the first small speckles of rust along the rocker panels. Directly across the room, she saw the framed batik butterfly hanging on the wall over the dresser, and remembered with a superstitious lack of surprise that it had been a 30th birthday present from Ruth. She couldn't see the tiny signature stitched in red thread from over here, but she knew it was there. Neary, 83. Another science fiction year. Not far from the butterfly, and clashing like mad, although she had never quite summoned enough nerve to point this out to her husband, Gerald's Alpha Gamma Rho Bierstein hung from a chrome peg. Rho wasn't a very bright star in the fraternity universe. The other frat rats used to call it Alpha Grabaho, but Gerald wore that pin with a perverse sort of pride, and kept the stein on the wall and drank the first beer of the summer out of it each year when they came down here in June. It was the sort of ceremony that had sometimes made her wonder, long before today's festivities, if she had been mentally competent when she married Gerald. Somebody should have put a stop to it, she thought drearily. Somebody really should have, because just look how it turned out. In the chair on the other side of the bathroom door, she could see the saucy little culotte skirt and the sleeveless blouse she had worn down on this unseasonably warm fall day. Her bra hung on the bathroom doorknob, and lying across the bedspread in her legs, turning the tiny soft hairs on her upper thighs to golden wires, was a bright band of afternoon sunlight. not the square of light that lay almost dead center on the bedspread at 1 o'clock, and not the rectangle which lay on it at 2. This was a wide band that would soon narrow to a stripe, and although a power outage had buggered the readout of the digital clock radio on the dresser, it flashed 12 a.m. over and over, as relentless as a neon bar sign. The band of light told her it was going on 4 o'clock. Before long, the stripe would start to slide off the bed, and she would see shadows in the corners and under the little reading table over by the wall. And as the stripe became a string, first slipping across the floor and then climbing up the far wall, fading as it went, those shadows would begin to creep out of their places and spread across the room like ink stains, eating the light as they grew. The sun was westering. In an hour and a half at most, it would be going down. 40 minutes or so after that, it would be dark. This thought didn't cause panic, at least not yet, but it did lay a membrane of gloom over her mind and a dank atmosphere of dread over her heart. She saw herself lying here, handcuffed to the bed with Gerald dead on the floor beside and below her. Saw them lying here in the dark long after the man with a chainsaw had gone back to his wife and kids and well-lighted home. And the dog had wandered away, and there was only that damned loon out there on the lake for company. Only that, and nothing more. Mr. and Mrs. Gerald Burlingame, spending one last long night together. Looking at the beer stein and the batik butterfly, unlikely neighbors which could only be tolerated in a one-season-a-year house such as this one, Jessie thought that it was easy to think about the past, and just as easy, although a lot less pleasant, to go wandering off into possible versions of the future. The really tough job seemed to be staying in the present, but she thought she'd better try her best to do it. This nasty situation was probably going to get a lot nastier if she didn't. She couldn't depend on some deus ex machina to help her get out of the jam she was in, and that was a bummer. But if she succeeded in doing it herself, there would be a bonus. She'd be saved the embarrassment of lying here almost starkers while some sheriff's deputy unlocked her, asked what the hell had happened, and got a nice long look at the new widow's fair white body, all at the same time. There were two other things going on as well. She would have given a lot to push them away, even temporarily, but she couldn't. She needed to go to the bathroom, and she was thirsty. Right now, the need to ship was stronger than the need to receive, but it was her desire for a drink of water that worried her. It wasn't a big deal yet, but that would change if she wasn't able to shuck the cuffs and get to a faucet. It would change in ways she didn't like to think of. It'd be funny if I died of thirst 200 yards from the 9th biggest lake in Maine, she thought. And then she shook her head. This wasn't the 9th biggest lake in Maine. What had she been thinking of? That was Dark Score Lake, the one where she and her parents and her brother and sister had gone all those years ago. Back before the voices. Back before... She cut that off, hard. It had been a long time since she'd thought about Dark Score Lake, and she didn't intend to start now, handcuffs or no handcuffs. Better to think about being thirsty. What's to think about, Toots? It's psychosomatic, that's all. You're thirsty because you know you can't get up and get a drink. It's as simple as that. But it wasn't. She'd had a fight with her husband, and the two swift kicks she'd dealt him had started a chain reaction which finally resulted in his death. She herself was suffering the after effects of a major hormone spill. The technical term for it was shock, and one of the commonest symptoms of shock was thirst. She should probably count herself lucky that her mouth was no drier than it was, at least so far, and maybe that's the one thing I can do something about. Gerald was the quintessential creature of habit, and one of his habits was keeping a glass of water on his side of the shelf above the headboard of the bed. She twisted her head up and to the right, and yes, there it was, a tall glass of water with a little cluster of melting ice cubes floating on top. The glass was no doubt sitting on a coaster so it wouldn't leave a ring on the shelf. That was Gerald, so considerate about the little things. Beads of condensation stood out on the glass like sweat. Looking at these, Jessie felt her first pang of real thirst. It made her lick her lips. She slid to the right as far as the chain on the left handcuff would allow. This was only 6 inches, but it brought her onto Gerald's side of the bed. The movement also exposed several dark spots on the left side of the coverlet. She stared at these vacantly for several moments before remembering how Gerald had voided his bladder in his last agony. Then she quickly turned her eyes back to the glass of water, sitting up there on a round of cardboard which probably advertised some brand of yuppie suds, Beck's or Heineken being the most likely. She reached out and up, doing it slowly, willing her reach to be long enough. It wasn't. The tips of her fingers stopped 3 inches short of the glass. The pang of thirst, a slight tightening in the throat, a slight prickle on the tongue, came and went again. If no one comes or I can't think of a way to wiggle free by tomorrow morning, I won't even be able to look at that glass. This idea had about it a cold reasonableness that was terrifying in and of itself. But she wouldn't still be here tomorrow morning, that was the thing. The idea was totally ridiculous. Insane, as a matter of fact. Loopy. Not worth thinking about. It... Stop, the no-bullshit voice said. Just stop. And so she did. The thing she had to face was that the idea wasn't totally ridiculous. She refused to accept or even entertain the possibility that she could die here. That was Loopy, of course. But she could be in for some long, uncomfortable hours if she didn't dust away the cobwebs on the old thinking machine and get it running. Long, uncomfortable, and maybe painful, the good wife said nervously. But the pain would be an act of atonement, wouldn't it? After all, you brought this on yourself. I hope I'm not being tiresome, but if you just let him shoot his squirt... You are being tiresome, Goody, Jessie said. She couldn't remember if she had ever spoken out loud to one of the interior voices before. She wondered if she was going mad. She decided she didn't give much of a shit one way or another, at least for the time being. Jessie closed her eyes again. This time it wasn't her body she visualized in the darkness behind her lids, but this whole room. Of course she was still the centerpiece, gosh, yes, Jessie Mayhoot Burlingame. Still a shade under 40, still fairly trim at 5'6 and 125 pounds. Blue eyes, brownish-red hair. She covered the gray that had begun to show up about 5 years ago with a glossy rinse and was fairly sure Gerald had never known. Jessie Mayhoot Burlingame, who had gotten herself into this mess without quite knowing how or why. Jessie Mayhoot Burlingame, now presumably the widow of Gerald, still mother of no one, and tethered to this goddamn bed by 2 sets of police handcuffs. She made the imaging part of her mind zoom in on these last. A furrow of concentration appeared between her closed eyes. 4 cuffs in all, each pair separated by 6 inches of rubber-sleeved steel chain, each with M17, a serial number, she assumed, stamped into the steel of the lock plate. She remembered Gerald telling her, back when the game was new, that each cuff had a notched take-up arm, which made the cuff adjustable. It was also possible to shorten the chains until a prisoner's hands were jammed painfully together, wrist to wrist. But Gerald had allowed her the maximum length of chain. And why the hell not, she thought now. After all, it was only a game. Right, Gerald? Yet now her earlier question occurred to her, and she wondered again if it had ever really been just a game for Gerald. What's a woman? Some other voice, a UFO voice, whispered softly from some well of darkness deep inside her. A life support system for a cunt. Go away, Jessie thought. Go away, you're not helping. But the UFO voice declined the order. Why does a woman have a mouth and a cunt? It asked instead. So she can piss and moan at the same time. Any other questions, little lady? No. Given the unsettlingly surreal quality of the answers, she had no other questions. She rotated her hands inside the cuffs. The scant flesh of her wrists dragged against the steel, making her wince. But the pain was minor and her hands turned easily enough. Gerald might or might not have believed that a woman's only purpose in life was to serve as a life support system for a cunt, but he hadn't tightened the cuffs enough to hurt. She would have balked at that even before today, of course. Or so she told herself. And none of the interior voices were mean enough to dispute her on the subject. Still, they were too tight to slip out of. Or were they? Jessie gave them an experimental tug. The cuffs slid up her wrists as her hands came down, and then the steel bracelets wedged firmly against the junctions of bone and cartilage where the wrists made their complex and marvelous alliances with her hands. She yanked harder. Now the pain was much more intense. She suddenly remembered the time Daddy had slammed the driver's side door of their old country squire station wagon on Maddie's left hand, not knowing she was sliding out on his side for a change instead of on her own. How she had screamed. It had broken some bone, Jessie couldn't remember the name of it. But she did remember Maddie proudly showing off her soft cast and saying, "I also tore my posterior ligament." That had struck Jess and Will funny, because everyone knew that your posterior was the scientific name for your sit-upon. They had laughed, more in surprise than in scorn, but Maddie had gone storming off just the same, her face as dark as a thundercloud, to tell Mommy. Posterior ligament, she thought, deliberately applying more pressure in spite of the escalating pain. Posterior ligament and radio ulnar something or other. Doesn't matter. If you can slip out of these cuffs, I think you better do it, Toots, and let some doctor worry about putting Humpty back together again later on. Slowly, steadily, she increased the pressure, willing the handcuffs to slip down and off. If they would just go a little way, a quarter of an inch might do it, and a half was almost for sure. She would be past the bulkiest ridges of bone and would have more yielding tissue to deal with, or so she hoped. There were bones in her thumbs, of course, but she would worry about them when and if the time came. She pulled down harder, her lips parting to show her teeth in a grimace of pain and effort. The muscles on her upper arms now stood out in shallow white arcs. Sweat began to bead her brow, even the slight indentation of her philtrum below her nose. She poked out her tongue and licked off this last without being aware of it. There was a lot of pain, but the pain wasn't what caused her to stop. What did was the simple realization that she had gotten to the point of maximum pull her muscles would provide, and it hadn't moved the cuffs a whit further down than they were right now. Her brief hope of simply squeezing out of this flickered and died. "Are you sure you pulled as hard as you could? Or are you maybe only kidding yourself a little because it hurts so much?" "No," she said, still not opening her eyes. "I pulled as hard as I could, really." But that other voice remained, actually more glimpsed than heard, something like a comic book question mark. There were deep white grooves in the flesh of her wrists, below the pad of the thumb, across the back of the hand, and over the delicate blue tracings of vein below, where the steel had bitten in. And her wrists continued to throb painfully, even though she had taken off all the pressure of the cuffs by raising her hands until she could grip one of the headboard slats. "Oh, boy," she said, her voice shaky and uneven. "Doesn't this just suck the big one?" Had she pulled as hard as she could? Had she really? Doesn't matter, she thought, looking up at the shimmers of reflection on the ceiling. Doesn't matter, and I'll tell you why. If I am capable of pulling harder, what happened to Maddie's left wrist when the car door slammed on it is going to happen to both of mine. Bones are going to break. Posterior ligaments are going to snap like rubber bands. And radio ulnar hoojiggies are going to explode like clay pigeons in a shooting gallery. The only thing that would change is that instead of lying here chained and thirsty, I'd be lying here chained, thirsty, and with a pair of broken wrists thrown into the bargain. They'd swell, too. What I think is this. Gerald died before he ever had a chance to climb into the saddle. But he fucked me good and proper just the same. Okay. What other options were there? None, Goodwife Burlingame said in the watery tone of a woman who is just a teardrop away from breaking down completely. Jessie waited to see if the other voice, Ruth's voice, would weigh in with an opinion. It didn't. For all she knew, Ruth was floating around in the office water cooler with the rest of the loons. In any case, her abdication left her to fend for herself. So, okay, fend, she thought. What are you going to do about the handcuffs, now that you've ascertained simply slipping out of them is impossible? What can you do? There are two handcuffs in each set. The young voice, the one she hadn't found a name for, spoke up hesitantly. You've tried to slip out of the ones with your hands inside them, and it didn't work. But what about the others? The ones hooked to the bedposts. Have you thought about them? Jessie pressed the back of her head into her pillow and arched her neck so she could look at the headboard and the bedposts. The fact that she was looking at these things upside down barely registered. The bed was smaller than a king or a queen, but quite a bit larger than a twin. It had some sort of fancy name, court jester size maybe, or chief lady-in-waiting, but she found it harder and harder to keep track of such things as she got older. She didn't know if you called that good sense or encroaching senility. In any case, the bed on which she now found herself had been just right for screwing, but a little too small for the two of them to share comfortably through the night. For her and Gerald, that hadn't been a drawback, because they had slept in separate rooms, both here and in the Portland house for the last 5 years. It had been her decision, not his. She had gotten tired of his snoring, which seemed to get a little worse every year. On the rare occasions when they had overnight guests down here, she and Gerald slept together, uncomfortably, in this room. But otherwise, they had shared this bed only when they had sex. And his snoring hadn't been the real reason she had moved out. It had just been the most diplomatic one. The real reason had been olfactory. Jessie had first come to dislike and then actually loathe the aroma of her husband's night sweat. Even if he showered just before coming to bed, the sour smell of Scotch whiskey began to creep out of his pores by 2 the next morning. Until this year, the pattern had been increasingly perfunctory sex followed by a period of drowsing. This had actually become her favorite part of the whole business, after which he would shower and leave her. Since March, however, there had been some changes. The scarves and the handcuffs, particularly the latter, had seemed to exhaust Gerald in a way plain old missionary-style sex never had, and he often fell deeply asleep next to her, shoulder to shoulder. She didn't mind this. Most of these encounters had been matinees, and Gerald smelled like plain old sweat instead of a weak scotch and water afterwards. He didn't snore much either, come to think of it. But all those sessions, all those matinees with the scarves and the handcuffs, were in the Portland house, she thought. We spent all of July and most of August down there. But on the occasions when we had sex, there weren't many, but there were some. It was just plain old pot roast and mashed potatoes kind. Tarzan on top, Jane on the bottom. We never played the game down here until today. Why was that, I wonder? Probably it had been the windows, which were too tall and oddly cut for drapes. They had never gotten around to replacing the clear glass with reflective sheets, although Gerald had continued to talk about doing that right up to, well, right up until today, Goody finished. And Jessie blessed her tact. And you're right. It probably was the windows, at least mostly. He wouldn't have liked Fred Lagland or Jamie Brooks driving in to ask on the spur of the moment if he wanted to play 9 holes of golf, and seeing him boffing Mrs. Burlingame, who just happened to be attached to the bedpost with a pair of Krieg handcuffs. Word on something like that would probably get around. Fred and Jamie are good enough fellows, I guess. A couple of middle-aged pukes, if you ask me, Ruth broke in sourly. But they're only human, and a story like that would have been too good not to talk about. And there's something else, Jessie. Jessie didn't let her finish. This wasn't a thought she wanted to hear articulated in the goodwife's pleasant but hopelessly prissy voice. It was possible that Gerald had never asked her to play the game down here because he had been afraid of some crazy joker popping out of the deck. What joker? Well, she thought, let's just say that there might have been a part of Gerald that really did believe a woman was just a life support system for a cunt, and that some other part of him, one I would call Gerald's better nature, for want of a clearer term, knew it. That part could have been afraid that things might get out of control. After all, isn't that just what happened? It was a hard idea to argue with. If this didn't fit the definition of out of control, Jessie didn't know what did. She felt a moment of wistful sadness and had to restrain an urge to look back toward the place where Gerald lay. She didn't know if she had grief in her for her late husband or not. But she did know that if it was there, this wasn't the time to deal with it. Still, it was nice to remember something good about the man with whom she had spent so many years. And the memory of the way he had sometimes fallen asleep beside her after sex was a good one. She hadn't liked the scarves, and had come to loathe the handcuffs. But she had liked looking at him as he drifted off, had liked the way his lines smoothed out of his large pink face. And in a way, he was sleeping beside her again right now, wasn't he? That idea chilled even the flesh of her upper thighs, where the narrowing patch of sun lay. She turned the thought aside, or at least tried to, and went back to studying the head of the bed. The posts were set in slightly from the sides, leaving her arms spread, but not uncomfortably so, particularly with the 6 inches or so of free play afforded by the handcuffed chains. There were 4 horizontal boards running between the posts. These were also mahogany, and engraved with simple but pleasing wave shapes. Gerald had once suggested that they have their initials carved in the center board. He knew of a man in Tashmore Glen, would be happy to drive over and do it, he said. But she had poured cold water on the idea. It seemed both ostentatious and strangely childish to her, like teeny bop sweethearts carving hearts on their study hall desks. The bed shelf was set above the topmost board, just high enough to ensure that no one sitting up suddenly would bump his or her head. It held Gerald's glass of water, a couple of paperbacks left over from the summer, and on her end a little strew of cosmetics. These were also left over from the summer gone by, and she supposed they were dried out by now. A real shame, too. Nothing cheered up a handcuffed woman more reliably than a little country morning rose blusher. All the women's magazines said so. Jessie lifted her hand slowly, holding her arms out at a slight angle so her fists wouldn't fetch up on the underside of the shelf. She kept her head back, wanting to see what happened on the far end of the chains. The other cuffs were clamped to the bedposts between the second and third headboards. As she lifted her fisted hands, looking like a woman bench-pressing an invisible barbell, the cuffs slid along the posts until they reached the next board up. If she could pull that board off, and the one above it, she would be able to simply slip the handcuffs off the ends of the bedposts. Voila! Probably too good to be true, hon. Too easy to be true. But you might as well give it a shot. It's a way to pass the time, anyway. She wrapped her hands around the engraved horizontal board, currently barring any further upward progress for the cuffs clamped to the bedposts. She took a deep breath, held it, and yanked. One hard tug was enough to tell her that that way was also blocked. It was like trying to pull a steel retaining rod out of a concrete wall. She could not feel even a millimeter's worth of give. I could yank on that bastard for 10 years and not even move it, let alone pull it off the bedpost, she thought, and let her hands fall back to their former slack, chain-supported position above the bed. A despairing little cry escaped her. To her it sounded like the caw of a thirsty crow. "What am I going to do?" she asked the shimmers on the ceiling, and at last gave way to desperate, frightened tears. "Just what in the hell am I going to do?" As if in answer, the dog began to bark again, and this time it was so close it scared her into a scream. It sounded, in fact, as if it was right outside the east window, in the driveway.